back to the Seven Commandments. And I said at one point that they really aren't seven, as you know, but they are they're only seven headings. And I would just like to demonstrate to you exactly what that means, because, you know, I can make a statement, but, you know, when you learn to tell them, you got to prove your statement. You can't just ask people to rely on good faith. Now, I just want to clarify, just so you should get, I'm not going to go into how many there are, because this is not an exact toll, but just to give you an example. The sexual restrictions for the Ben Noach. So immediately there are six. Immediately six basic ones. Okay, and there's living with a mother, with the wife of the father, even though it's not the mother, with another man's wife, with his sister from his mother, with a male or with an animal. So right away you have six. Now, in the count of the Taryag, of the 613, you see, in the 613 count, for the Ben Israel, that would immediately be six. Okay? So you'd have six right there. Now, again, let's take the one on theft. Now, the one on theft involves, I haven't made a real count. That would be a study in itself. But I could tell you right away, it's upwards of 18. Right away. You have not paying a worker. You have you have four right away, according to Nachmanides, for sure. You have the four types of damages, ways of damaging people, either physically with your money, with your something you own, that is, with a if you make a pit, for instance, that somebody falls into. That's already damages. You're obligated for that, even though you didn't do it. You know, you only caused the damage, but that's considered damage. There's four categories right there. You've got if a person would have a business where scales are not accurate. That would be another one. There's upwards of 18 and up, right away. Stealing, for instance, would involve also kidnapping, which is a separate commandment for the Ben Israel, in the system of the 613. So the sixth, right away, like I say, in each, and for instance, take for instance courts, the setting up courts, you'd have at least six or seven right there to set up courts. And not to show any deference to a wealthy person or kindness to a poor person and have him win a case, you'd have several right there. So I didn't make an accurate count, as I said, but the I know some people claim 60 in the 60s, whatever it is. But the point I'm making is that when you say seven mitzvot, seven commandments, you do not mean commandments in the same sense that you mean in the 613 system. This is the point I'm trying to make, that the term commandments over here is not synonymous with the term commandments used in the 613. Over here, they are basically, as you refer to them, as headings or themes, okay? I would say themes. Now, we'll get back to that concept in a moment. My question here is there anything like that for the Ben Israel, a concept like that for the Ben Israel? Maybe somebody has, if somebody has an answer, I'll take it. If not, I'll tell you what it is. The answer is yes, there is, and that is in the Ten Commandments. Okay, the Ten Commandments also are not really ten mitzvot. Over there, there are several that are idolatry. For instance, involves several of them, several commandments. So numerically, they are more than ten. In terms of, if you count them as commandments in the system of Tayag, they're called the ten words. Really, not the ten commandments. Ten commandments is a misnomer. Moses referred to them as the dibros, aseres ha-devorim, the ten words or themes. Okay. So therefore, you see, for the Ben Israel as well, there is a concept that sometimes we deal with themes, sometimes we deal with commandments as meaning, when I say commandments now, I mean commandments as they would be counted in the 613 system. Okay? So you have two systems here. You have a system of commandments, per se, and then you have a system of themes. Now, the reason why you have, why it's called, as a matter of fact, Maimonides, who is the genius of precise definition, in his formulation, he doesn't say, when he starts off to talk about the seven commandments for the Ben Noah, he doesn't call it commandments at first. He says, on six things, Adam the first was commanded. Okay, he uses the word divarim, things. Then, it comes out that there are sheva mitzvot. What he's trying to tell you is that the term sheva mitzvot, seven commandments, which are used by the rabbis, by the Talmud, does not mean really commandments in the same sense as we count the 613 system. Not the same sense. They're called that way because the word commandment means something that was commanded by God. So in that sense, they're commanded. They're commandments. But they're not commandments in the sense of the numerical, the method of numerical valuation that are given to the that are used in the system of the 613. Okay. Now, why is this so? I believe the reason is something that we've discussed, and that is that when we say the seven commandments, see, the seven commandments map out. They map out something. They map out the minimal lifestyle of a society that is worthy in God's eyes of existence. So it is the minimal level the minimal level of societal righteousness. So it's mapping out over here a lifestyle. Now, when you're mapping out a lifestyle, so then the themes are the important thing, not the numerical valuation of breaking it down into how many commandments. The point over here is that if you're mapping out a lifestyle, it is the themes that are central in doing in such a process. Whereas if you're trying to count how many commandments were given, then every time you have a different form, you have to count it as a different commandment. Now, we've mentioned last time when we studied the commandment and the process of studying the commandment of blasphemy. So we mentioned that why is it that the death penalty is given for in every case, and we said that the reason why is because it's not the violation per se that incurs the death penalty. It's the refusal to commit to this lifestyle, this minimal lifestyle that involves the forfeiture of a person's life. In other words, if a person says he's not going to commit to the seven, it means he's not committing to the basic lifestyle that God has established as the most rudimentary lifestyle for human societal existence. So it's not the particular action which is for which he's being punished. It's for the lack of commitment to that minimal lifestyle. So again, in such a case, we're speaking in terms of themes. And the same thing is true of the Ten Commandments, because the Ten Commandments, when they were given, were given as a means of creating a bris, a covenant between God and Israel. Those commandments were used as a vehicle of creating the covenant. And if you're speaking of commandments in terms of a vehicle of a covenant, which is again a lifestyle, then it is the themes that are important and not counting up the particular forms of the commandments. So you have it in the Bible, you have it in two cases. You have it in the case of the Ten Commandments, and you have it in the case of the seven laws of Noah. Okay? The way we count depends upon what we are doing. If we are speaking about mapping out a specific lifestyle or creating an entity of a covenant, then it is the themes that are important. But if we're speaking about counting up how many specific forms of commandments there are, then we use the method of the 613, where each one counts as a separate, each one is a separate form, has a separate form, its own structure, its own halachic structure, and its own identity. So, that's the first point I had wished to make. Okay, to prove, there is a very interesting statement in the Talmud, and it's in the Tractate of Chulin, and it is an obscure statement. The commentaries, Rashi for one, admits that he just doesn't understand he doesn't know the source of the statement. Our scholars are very honest. If they don't know the source, they don't know the source. But the statement of Talmud is nevertheless existing. And I'll tell you what, it's a strange statement. It's in the Tractate of Chulin, and it's in 92A goes over to 92B. Okay. So, it says like this. It says that, it says that there were 30 there were 30 commandments that the B'nai Noah accepted upon themselves. So Rashi, the great commentary Rashi, says, I don't know exactly what these 30 are and how that breakdown of 30 takes place. Okay, but obviously from the Talmud you see that it's more than seven. My method would be, the method that I was using was to simply take the heading and then go back to the 613 and see how, under each heading, how many there would be. Like I mentioned, the stealing, there'd be at least 18. But it'll come up to more than 30, so that system won't work. Obviously Rashi thought of that system and saw that that system will not work. So what exactly is meant by 30? Is obscure. We just don't know what it means. But the statement of Talmud continues, and it says that practically speaking, the world at large has only kept three. And it's a strange piece of Talmud. I mean, I don't mind telling you, repeating to you, a strange piece of Talmud. We learn a lot of things that we don't understand. We just, you know, you keep in the back of mind, maybe one day we will understand it. But there's nothing wrong in our system of education with studying things we don't understand. Now, it's a strange piece of Talmud. Talmud says that what are the three that they did keep? Okay. One of them is, today it's a big issue, as a matter of fact. One of them is that even though they didn't keep the ban, remember, this is speaking about the world on the whole. It's not speaking about individuals, righteous individuals. It's speaking about general society. It says even though they didn't keep the ban against homosexuality, but they didn't live with men. Men and men, a male and a male did not live together in a manner like man and wife. In other words, they didn't write a contract. That's exactly what's going on today, by the way. That the homosexuals want to have recognition of marriage between the same sex as just as there is recognition of marriage. It should be a legal phenomenon. That just like you have a man and a wife is a legal institution. The homosexuals want that the homosexual relationship should also be valid and should be treated in the same manner, tax-wise, et cetera, in the eyes of the state. So it's funny, it's interesting that Talmud says that that never happened, at least up to the time of the Talmud, that far they never went, to recognize the lifestyle of, even though they violated the prohibition against homosexuality, but they never they never considered it as, they didn't write a contract between homosexual and homosexual relations. They never wrote a contract and recognized it as a valid legal marriage. Okay? It's amazing that that is really, that is the issue today. But this is what, this is one thing that Talmud says that, that society at large kept. And another one, another one which is really cryptic, we don't, what Rashi explains, it says that they avoided cannibalism. Okay? They avoided cannibalism. And, there again, there is no, again, that's a problem because, as I said, as I mentioned before, cannibalism is certainly, I mean, to kill another person would be murder, but that's one of the seven. But you could have cannibalism without killing somebody. You could just eat a cadaver, and that really wouldn't involve one of the seven. So why does the Talmud, mention this? But there again, if we understand the seven as mapping out a lifestyle, there is no question that cannibalism, as I mentioned before, that even though the Torah does not specifically outlaw cannibalism, it is in the 613, it would be a come under a minor violation, sort of. Not like, it wouldn't be the same kind of violation as murder. In the seven, we don't have it. It doesn't appear as cannibalism per se. It would appear as murder, but nevertheless, it's in, this piece of Talmud is in conformity with the fact that the seven are the mapping out of a minimal lifestyle, and the avoidance of cannibalism would be an indication of the fact that at least the society never stooped below the level of the base level of human existence, that never stooped to cannibalism. In other words, basically what Talmud is saying is that they, is that the world at large came out of the cannibalistic state. Okay? And then the third thing it mentioned is that they have a respect for the Torah. That in general, there is a respect among the nations for the Torah. So it's a strange, it is a strange piece of Talmud. I mean, Rashi is perplexed by it, and it is difficult. I mean, I don't really claim to be able to explain it, but it is an interesting piece of Talmud that it states that there were three things that were kept basically, and those three things are, as I mentioned before, not to recognize a homosexual relationship as a legitimate marriage, the avoidance of cannibalism, and a certain respect for Torah. There again, we're not speaking in terms of the seven commandments per se, because one of them is not to respect the Torah, even though that is obviously included in the framework, because the reason why the Ben Noach is supposed to keep his seven commandments is based on the fact that he accepts the Torah. But what we see over here is that there is a different system. The 30 system is a different kind of a system, which we don't know exactly what was meant by that system. But it is an interesting piece of Talmud. I wanted to bring it to your attention. I think that, even though we don't understand it, as I said before, it's something to keep in the back of your mind. Maybe, perhaps, as we continue to study, maybe we will be able to shed some light on that Talmudic statement. Now let's see. Let us progress a little further back with the Talmud that we were doing over here. By the way, that piece of Talmud is not, is sort of like, a lot of times the Talmud has side comments. That's like a side comment. That's not really a piece of Talmud that is involved in the strict analysis of the seven laws of Noah. And, in studying Talmud, I often mention it's not an easy science, because you have to know what is really an analysis of a system per se, and what is a side comment that is might be understood on a philosophical plane. You see, there are different levels of discussion in the Talmud. A scholar learns how to distinguish between the strict study of the science and then casual statements that are of philosophical significance, the different level of statement. It's a different kind of a statement. Okay. So let's get back to the strict study of the seven laws, which is found in the Tractate of Sanhedrin, and which we were working on previously. Now in the study of the seven, we left off with the various statements, arguments of the scholars, and the analysis of the seven. Okay. And the question that we had was, how do you explain that Talmud, in the very same breath, states there are seven, and then it proceeds to add several more? And we'll see that there is a method of understanding what the Talmud means here. Now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to return to a position that we had studied previously, and that position is that sorcery or magic is one of the things that the Ben Noah is prohibited from. And this is Rabbi Josi. He says everything that's mentioned in the chapter on sorcery, the Ben Noah must follow precisely. Okay? In other words, that's it's not simply idolatry, but even sorcery must be removed from the societal framework of all human beings. Now, this is an argument. Not everybody agrees with him. Others maintain, again, everybody maintains that the avoidance of superstition and sorcery is definitely a perfection in man. But we're not speaking about that when we're speaking about the seven laws. The seven laws are speaking about the minimal level of human existence. And the question is, if you have a society that doesn't serve idols, not idolatrous, believes in one God, believes that the God is not physical, God is the source of all creation, fine. But they are superstitious. If a black cat walks across the trail, then they will think something terrible is going to happen. All right, is that a society that is in violation, doesn't deserve to exist, or no? It's not optimum, but it doesn't mean that the society is doomed. I mean, it doesn't mean that in God's eyes the society is not worthy of existence. This is the question that the Talmud is dealing with, and this is what the seven commandments are about. It's describing the most basic lifestyle, and the Talmud has a debate about this. It's something like, I mean, basically, you might say our society, where horoscopes are read, and people believe these kind of things. I mean, if you put on television, you'll see they'll tell you can call certain people or go to a séance where you'll be introduced to the dead, things like that. These are all the things the Torah prohibits. So the question is that kind of society considered in God's eyes as being beneath the basic fundamental level of human existence or not? It's not the best society, but it can exist in God's eyes. That's the question. Okay, now Rabbi Josi attempts to prove his point. I mean, if he makes a statement, he has to back it up. And he backs it up very nicely. He backs it up with the text of the Bible, and that is from Deuteronomy 18. Okay? Now, in Deuteronomy 18, we find that and I went through, I believe we did go through, the breakdown of some of those things that are mentioned in Deuteronomy 18 and what exactly they are. So I'm not going to repeat that. But I'm going to get directly to his proof. His proof is as follows. In Deuteronomy 18, it states, 18:9, all right, that you will come to the land that the Lord your God has given you. You shall not learn to do as the abominations of these nations. All right. Now, what are these abominations? And then it proceeds to explain them. 10. It is passing the son and daughter through fire, which was one form of idolatry. And then it goes into the various different forms of idolatry, which we went through last time, seeking the dead, determining the future through mediums, and all these things that we're pretty much familiar with, okay? Maybe, perhaps at a later time, after we finish the seven commandments, we can, seven mitzvot, actually, seven themes, we can go into what these things are in specific, because they're very interesting. But let's not do that right now. Let's go ahead to verse 12. Verse 12 is the key from which Rabbi Josi uses, the key point that Rabbi Josi used to support his argument. And then it says like this. It says, because it is the abomination of God, whoever does these things. Whoever does these things is an abomination before God. Those individuals. And because of these abominations, God your God is driving out these people from before you. Okay? Now here's an interesting point. God is just, and God would not give the land of Canaan, the land of Israel, to the Jewish people if the people that were there before deserved to live there. That was their place. They were there first. So God would not, since God is just in all his ways, and he's just to every single nation, and if you study Deuteronomy, you'll see each one has their own, Esau has his inheritance, and we are not permitted to make changes over there. I mean, everyone has their rights. So therefore, what the Torah is telling us here is that if it weren't, and that's really what was stated to Abraham at the very outset, that the his seed cannot inherit the land at this point because they hadn't reached a level of wickedness where they deserve to be the inhabitants deserve to be driven from the land. But at the time when the people of Israel were ready as a nation to move into the land of Israel, God said that at that point, the sins of the nations that were the inhabitants of that land had reached a point where they simply did not deserve to continue to exist as a society, and therefore they were driven from the land. Okay? That's exactly what the verse means in verse 12. Because of these abominations, God your God is driving them out and giving you this land. All right? Then the final verse, which is an important one, it says, you shall be whole, complete, with the Lord your God, which means to say that's a summation of everything before. That means to say that anyone that believes in any kind of magical forces, devils, other kind of existences, is not complete with God because he thinks there are other forces out there besides God. So that's a summation of the whole chapter. What Rabbi Josi says is as follows. Rabbi Josi says that we have a principle, and this is a principle given to us at Sinai in how to interpret the Torah. And the principle is that there is no such thing as punishment without sin. Okay? Whenever the Bible indicates punishment, it must also, ipso facto, must indicate sin. Because the Bible is not a book of punishment, it's a book of perfection. And if there is a punishment, the purpose of the punishment is in order to remove an imperfection and to perfect society and to perfect the individual. Okay? That in general, by the way, is our attitude towards punishment from God. We say that the Bible says in Deuteronomy that God chastises a person as a father chastises a child, which means to say that punishment is really if a person would know that he is suffering because God has given him a punishment, he would be in a very good state, because that would mean that he is important enough for God to relate to him and to.
All right, here Lawrence is.
Go ahead.
Bro, they said that you believe anything out there besides God,
right?
That would be idolatry.
Yeah.
What about UFOs? That fall under the same category as something else out there?
That's a good question. Let me, you know, the answer, that's a good question. If a person believes that there are other natural phenomena out there, like other intelligences or you know, other creatures that were created by God that we don't know of in outer space, that would not constitute a violation of this precept, because then you're simply saying that God's creation extends beyond the Earth and the and beyond the our planetary system, and that there are other creations out there somewheres in the galaxies that God, that are part of God's creation, except they are different than us or something like that. If a person did believe that, then there would be nothing wrong with that. It's not a violation, because he's not really saying there is another force like God. But he's not saying it's a supernatural force. He's saying there are other creations, and he's saying perhaps, for instance, some scientists speculate, although there's no evidence for it, but sometimes scientists speculate that there is life somewhere in the galaxies, somewhere in the distant, remote corners of the universe. I use that expression figuratively, but there's nothing wrong with such speculation, because the person is simply saying that there are other creatures that that God made. I mean, even though one would say, well, how come it's not mentioned in the Bible? That is not necessarily a proof, because the Bible really is giving an exposition of creation essentially vis-a-vis man. It doesn't mean that it had to mention every single detail in the text of the creation in the first 6 days. So that would not be a violation. But here is where you get into a very fine point. And in order to answer that point, I will mention another question. The question is, can a person take medications, for instance, that certain things that people would do, weird things that people would do when they're ill. Some of the things we still have today, a lot of them have vanished, but let's say wearing a copper bracelet, I mean, or some kind of, a person has arthritis and they wear some kind of a charm or something, okay? Is that a violation? Well, the answer is that it depends on the mental state or the reasoning of the individual. We really are obliged to follow scientific knowledge. That's an obligation of the Torah. If a person is ill, he must go to the physician. All right. Now, let's say, and you're not permitted to use any kind of cures that the Talmud refers to as cures of the Amorites. That's exactly what the Bible means over here. Like, you're not permitted to use mystical kinds of cures. That is against the Torah. But, so now the question comes in, what kind of comes about? What is a mystical cure? I mean, is it anything that's not proven by science? Well, let's say I want to wear a copper bracelet. I have arthritis, I want to wear a copper bracelet. Is that considered a mystical cure, which would be prohibited? Or is it not considered a mystical cure? Now, the answer to that is a precise answer, but it is dependent upon the framework of the person. And this is the way it goes. If the person thinks that there is some magic in the bracelet, some supernatural force in the bracelet that's curing him, then it is definitely prohibited. That's the cures of the Amorites. That, again, is supernatural force, and you're maintaining there's some other force out there besides God, which means you're not whole and not complete with God. You believe in other forces. But if the person says, look, there could be a natural reason why this copper bracelet does help my arthritis. Science at this point doesn't know the reason, but that doesn't mean that 100 years from now they might not discover that somehow or other the atoms in the bracelet do have some kind of an effect, or perhaps it's a... it's an electromagnetic field that's created or something that might affect the arthritic joints or whatever. And if a person thinks that he's doing it because not everything that, we know works can be explained by science. We are the human mind. God said, commanded man, he says, when he created him, he said that you should conquer, conquest through science, through knowledge, through technology, and man plods along slowly and makes new headway. That's part of his mandate that was given to him from the first day he was created. So this is part of the scientific process which the Torah endorses. It only tells the Ben Israel that he must stop that on the Sabbath, but the rest of the week he's supposed to progress. So this is fine. This is all in line with man, God giving man his divine image and his ability to uncover the secrets of nature, how they work, to take part in God's wisdom, insofar as his human mind is capable of. This is all wonderful. This is all what the Torah wants us to do. But we know that we make progress in slow steps. So if a person says, well, look, I'm not going to wait around for science to find out that a copper bracelet works. It works for me, and it could be the reason escapes science at this point, but maybe 100 years from now they'll find out the reason. If you do it in that frame of mind, then it's 100% permissible. Then it's not considered the ways of the Amorites, medications, mystical medicine. But if a person believes that there is something, they wear something around their neck, and they think that this thing has some kind of a power, that it's a supernatural power that is curing the disease, then the person is in serious violation, because then they're maintaining there is a supernatural force and there is other than God. You see, that's where the violation comes in. So in answering your question, it's important to know the mindset of the individual. If the person is looking, and here's where you cross cross boundaries. Because there are respectable scientists that are curious about life and intelligence other than humans. By the way, we do believe that there are intelligences other than humans, and we say they were created. The Talmud, the oral law, explains they were created on the second day. Those are angels, which means that there are intelligences, existences that are superior to us in intelligence and understand more about the about nature of the universe than we do. They have a higher level of knowledge of God. The angels don't have their own supernatural powers. I mean, we don't believe that. We believe their existence is on a different level, but they don't exercise their own supernatural powers. The only one that is God, that is the source of all all existences and all creation. But if a respectable scientist is investigating this phenomenon, there's nothing wrong with that. On the other hand, you have people that are mystically inclined and believe there are all kinds of forces and powers all over, and therefore they believe that these aliens are endowed with the belief in aliens is based upon the belief in the supernatural. If the belief in aliens is based upon the belief in the supernatural, then the person is not being complete with God. Then he's positing other forces. If it's a legitimate, scientific, intelligent question or investigation, then there is nothing wrong with it. And if a person is studying a UFO from a scientific point of view, there could be other beings that are more advanced than us, created by God. There's nothing wrong with that. But if it's catering to the supernatural, then he is in violation. So it depends on the mindset of the person who is conjecturizing. Okay, it depends what type of conjecture it is, just like in the case of the medicine. Okay, does that answer your question?
Yes, that answers the
question. Okay.
Lars said, say yes.
Okay. Any more questions or should I go on?
No, I think that was adequate.
Okay.
All right.
So now we'll go on. So now we see Rabbi Josie's proof. Rabbi Josie's proof is that we have a principle that is not argued. No one argues in this principle. None of the scholars are in this principle, which obviously indicates that it was received directly from Sinai and remained in its pure form in the days of the Talmud, which is that whenever the Bible speaks of a punishment, there has to have been a previous crime. So therefore, Rabbi Josi says, from this piece of Deuteronomy, namely 18:12, where it states that God is chasing out these nations because of these abominations, you must say that they were in violation. They were doing something wrong. Because otherwise, how could God punish them and chase them out of their land? Okay? And that would seem to be an ironclad argument. I mean, it's difficult really to argue with Rabbi Josi. His logic seems impeccable. Okay? And therefore, he says it must be that the seven laws of Noah include all these violations of sorcery, magic, witchcraft, mediums, seeking the dead, etc., etc., seances, all these type things. Must be that that's included, because that's precisely what the verse says. They're being chased out. They're being punished. Isn't that a punishment, to be chased out of your land? Obviously, it's not a good thing. It's a bad thing. It means God does not consider them as worthy of existence in their land, and he's removing them. Okay? That is his argument. And yet, by the way, the prevailing opinion is that is against Rabbi Josi, and that is that that sorcery and magic and witchcraft does not constitute one of the does not constitute a violation of the seven laws. Now, the question, of course, is seven. If sorcery is a violation, so why isn't it more than seven? But this, I think, we've been educated enough to be able to respond to, and that is that, as we mentioned before, it is not seven laws in the system of the 613 count. It is seven themes. So Rabbi Josi would answer us if we asked Rabbi Josi, hey, how could you say it's, that the sorcery is included? It'll make it eight. He'd say, no. It comes under the violation, under the heading of idolatry. So under idolatry, he would have many more commandments than the position of the other rabbis who disagreed with him. Okay, so you can't attack him from that standpoint. He would say, just like you have under setting up courts, you have several commandments, and under stealing, you have 18, 25, whatever it might be, so I too have under idolatry, I have several. That's not a problem, because that's the way the system works. Okay? So you can't attack him from that standpoint. And his argument from a logical standpoint, if you read the verse in the Bible, it would seem that it's inescapable. And the question that we have to raise is, what is the opinion? How do the other rabbis, the other position, how do they defend themselves against his logic? We, as I said, the prevailing opinion, Maimonides, does not accept the Rabbi Josi's opinion. He accepts the general opinion of the scholars, of the rabbis of the Talmud, know that even if a society did commit these things, they have mediums, they have seances, and all these different things, predictors of the future, etc., they're not in violation of the seven commandments. But so how would they deal with this verse in Deuteronomy 18:12? After all, you're dealing with a verse in the Bible. It's a serious matter. You can't just talk it away. Okay. If anybody has any suggestion, I would be glad to listen. If not, I will tell you what my own opinion is. All right?
We'll let you give your opinion.
Okay.
All right. You just wanted to make sure we were still alive.
Yes.
All right. We are here.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Now this is it's a little bit technical. Okay. But we're going to make a dash for it. All right. When you have a rule of the oral law system, you have to be able to analyze the rule and understand precisely its framework. Now, the rule that everybody accepted is that there is no such thing as punishment in the Bible without previous sin. Okay? Now, there are certain statements about, there are certain statements, certain certain principles that we use in analyzing the Bible. Some of those principles are strictly textual, which means to say they're principles that relate to how the structure of the Bible is. It doesn't mean, they're not principles that relate to reality. For instance, you're all familiar with a concept that there is no order in the biblical stories. Okay, there's no order. Now that is a principle that has to do with the text of the Bible itself. It doesn't have to do with reality. Reality, there's an order of events. There's a chronological order of events. But it's stating that the way the Bible recounts these events is not necessarily in the historical chronological order. Okay? So you can't deduce historical chronology from the Bible. That's not the purpose of the Bible, and the Bible, the text of the Bible is not conforming to that system. So this statement about order in the Bible is a statement about the biblical text. It's not a statement about reality. Now, the question arises, we have this formula. The formula states there is no such thing as punishment without previous sin. Now, the question is this. In the Bible, you have two different types of texts. You have one kind of text that deals with stories and events. All right? We're all familiar with that, stories and events. Then you have a text that deals with the legal system of the Bible. There is a very heavy legal system in the Torah, especially in Leviticus. Leviticus is completely the laws about, for instance, about the diseases, the blemishes on the on a person's skin. I mean, there's a whole system over there of laws of how, you know, what is considered, when is a nega, it's called, in Hebrew it's called a nega. It means a blemish, a certain kind of blemish on the skin, which has halachic value. There's a whole system over there. The laws of uncleanliness, the laws of kosher food, all these various systems in the Torah. Then the laws of punishment, the laws of the Sanhedrin, you know, the various violations and the punishments that, that are prescribed for these violations. Okay? So the system of the Torah, really, Torah takes up two different, if you want to break the Torah up, you can divide it into two different types of statements. There are statements that are part of the legal system, and then there are statements that are part of the story, historical, but I don't mean the chronological history, but events, okay? The events of Abraham, the events of Isaac, this is not the part of the legal system, okay? But where the Bible says that he who is a murderer should be put to death, that's part of the legal system, all right? So the Bible is composed of two separate units, so to speak. Now, this is the question. All the scholars agree that there is no such thing as punishment without previous sin. But the question is that in reference to the part of the Bible that deals with punishment and that deals with law, or is that a general principle throughout the Bible, even when we read about events? Okay? That was the argument between Rabbi Josi and the other scholars. Rabbi Josi maintained it's a general principle, and even if you're reading about events, then this principle has to apply. Whereas the other scholars of the Talmud agreed that that principle is true, but they said that is only if you're dealing with the verses that have to do with law. There we say, if we find a punishment, if the Bible says that if you do such and such, that you should be executed, then we say that implies a previous crime. Okay? But it doesn't necessarily mean that every area in the Bible where the Bible describes a punishment that befell a certain people, that this rule still applies. This rule is a legalistic rule. It's a halachic rule. It's a rule that has to do with the Bible system of law. But it's not a general rule that you can apply to the other parts of the Bible that deal with events that took place. Okay? So therefore, what the other scholars would maintain is as follows. Yes, it's true that these nations definitely lived a depraved existence. And the Bible is describing their depravity and how, you know, and all the things they did, all the violations that they did, which basically means that the society reached a level that they weren't deserving anymore of living in their land. But it doesn't necessarily mean that each one of these things that they did was a violation of the Ben Noah system. Okay? What the Bible is stating is that even, in other words, the Bible here is discussing a level of philosophical depravity that these people had reached. And because of that, God, in his judgment, removed them. They weren't deserving any more of this land, and he removed them from the land, and instead he placed the Israelites in that land. That is not a legalistic kind of judgment. That's not discussing what the seven laws are. Okay? What it's discussing is a certain, it's true, these things are abomination. But just because these things are abomination, and just because people that live that way don't deserve any more to live in the land of Israel, doesn't mean that is not a method of arriving at the seven basic laws. The seven basic laws have to stem from the system of law of the Torah. And in the system of law, in the system of law, these things are not mentioned as part of the seven. Let me give you an example, okay? Make it maybe clarify it a little more. I know at this point it sounds confusing. There are the six. Let's take the 613. Okay, you know right away, 613 doesn't mean that a Jew does 613 commandments even in his lifetime, because many of those commandments have to do with various areas, kings and priests, etc., etc. But there are some 80, 90, 100 commandments or so that are a part of a person's everyday life. Now, Nachmanides explains, he says, and I may have mentioned this before, that a person can keep all these commandments and yet live a depraved existence. There's no commandment against being drunk. So a person can get up, prays, does his minimal prayer, you know, and then the rest of the day he spends as a drunkard. Okay, or he takes drugs. There's nothing, nowhere in the Bible says you shouldn't take drugs. A person is a drug addict, okay? So Nachmanides explains that this person, and he wouldn't break a single law. He'll make sure he does not break a single law of the Torah. Right? Certainly before the rabbis added their injunctions, which of course they have a right to do, but certainly before that it was much easier to keep the basic 613. A person can spend his day indulging in gluttony. There's nowhere in the Bible that says he shouldn't be a glutton, correct? So a person can spend his day in gluttony, in drunkenness, and depravity, according to the biblical law, it would be very easy. Before, there was, of course, now Ben Israel is not permitted to marry more than one wife. But before that injunction, which was not a biblical injunction, he could have many wives. He can overindulge in sexuality, and he could spend his whole life basically like an animal, and yet be very careful to keep every one of the 613. Now, is he in violation of the 613? No. In God's eyes, is this person a worthy individual? Is he close to God? Does he have any relationship with God? The answer is obviously no. He doesn't. Okay? So, as we said many times, the Torah tries to guide a man to perfection. God legislated 613 commandments, which are beautiful vehicles of perfection, but a person, if he intends to, wishes to, we can avoid all of those and be depraved. So that's exactly what the rabbis are saying here, the ones that disagree with Rabbi Josi. They say the Torah here is describing the fact that these societies were so steeped in their in their primitive mystical involvement to the point where they were an abomination. Their lives were an abomination. That doesn't necessarily mean that that doesn't necessarily mean they violated the seven laws. That doesn't necessarily mean that these things constitute the seven laws. The seven laws is a system which is a which the Ben Noah is supposed to establish for his society, and they are seven laws. He's not supposed to establish. There's no law that says you can't be depraved, just like there's no law in the 613 for the Ben Israel. So therefore, what they say is you cannot deduce from these statements anything about the structure of the seven laws. The structure of the seven laws must come from that portion of the Bible that deals with legislation, okay? The legislative portion of the Bible. This is not legislative. This is a part of the Bible that deals with events and deals with things that God did and deals with certain peoples that were depraved. This is not the way to derive your seven laws. Seven laws is a legislative system, and this is not a legislative text, okay? This is a text that is dealing with a judgment of God because these people were depraved, that it gives you, it proceeds to tell you the manner in which they were depraved. And there's no doubt that if a Ben Noah was involved in these things, and that was his life, was his life was seances and superstition and magic. Obviously, this person is not close to God. And if the society did reach that level of depravity, God would consider them as unworthy. Yes.
Got about a minute.
Okay. So God would consider them as unworthy. But just because they are unworthy, it doesn't mean that the legislative system should incorporate those things which they did and render them unworthy. Okay? That is the argument of those who argue against Rabbi Josi. All right? Okay, I hope if there are any questions, I'd like you to think it over. And there is a fine distinction here. And if there are any questions, please raise them at our next session. Okay? Thank you, everybody, and good night.
All right. That'll work.